on rethinking prayer. And in this particular lesson within that series, we're talking about the prayer of confession. And because centuries do what they do, as time goes by, the purity of a practice or the purity of a thought tends to get barnacled or encrusted with barnacles through time as time goes by. And so it's helpful to go back to look at the original intent of a practice, the original intent of a belief system. And so we're doing that with the prayer of confession because it has become encrusted, barnacled through the centuries. And so we've talked about it in its original intent as a prayer of self-awareness and as a prayer of self-disclosure. So we're a little too far into the lesson to give a full recap, so let me just give a very brief one. We've been talking about this prayer practice in three steps. We pay attention to our negative emotions. We undertake a thorough self-examination, and we engage forthright disclosure. Now, we spent the last 2 weeks talking about step two. The tradition always encourages us to start with a prayer for help, a prayer that awakens us to what we've called the two-step dance of desire and pay attention, desire and pay attention. We make examine part of the rhythm of our daily lives, and in particularly, we use a list of the ancient virtues, and we just read through them slowly, making this part of the regular practice of our days. We listen in the in-between spaces. We pause. We wait for a nudge, a prompting, and then we reflect on what is stirred within us. We write things down. We do that because it helps marshal our attentiveness in ways that we don't marshal them when we don't write things down. Things that we write down go to a different place in our awareness than things we don't, we've seen. And then the heart of the practice we got to this last week was the asking of questions. We saw that the better questions we ask, the deeper our self-awareness goes. We saw how our questions are framed around this basic structure. We have a bad thought. We have a bad word. We have a bad deed. We kind of clustered these under the heading afflictive emotions. These things crop up in our lives, and when they do, the tradition teaches us, this is the time to initiate the prayer of confession. Afflictive emotions are our friends. That's the way that we've been saying it. The negative thought, the negative word, the negative deed is our friend in that it invites us into this practice, the quest to know what's going on inside. We spoke last week using a personal story about these layers that we've got designed up on the diagram. The stories we tell ourselves, that's the first place we go. What story am I telling myself that is causing this reaction, this response, this action? And how, we saw, are those stories better informed when we touch our feelings, when we get in touch with what it is that our body is telling us, the sensation, because we've seen that our minds will edit for us, but our bodies aren't sophisticated enough to edit for us. That gives us a gift that helps us know what story we actually are telling ourselves. And then we saw that if we've done this for a length of time, we start noticing the recurring patterns of our lives. We begin to see what are the core wounds that we carry, what are the core belief systems that have become toxic, what are the things that that we realize are just lurking down there, the old adversaries of our souls. So again, if you missed these last few weeks, I would encourage you to have a listen online. You'll hear a great deal more nuance and practical application that I can't go to in the recap. So let's finish up today the second part of the practice, the undertaking a thorough self-examination having to do with the questions we ask ourselves. I was meeting with a man in our community recently, and he was telling me about his insight into step two, into this thorough self-examination. And he was drawing from experience that he had gained by being a long-term participant in 12-step communities. And he picked up some very helpful tools, some very helpful ways of thinking about this practice of self-examination. I thought it would be good for us before we leave this part of the lesson to go in and look at that. Here's something that is less and less true the more that we understand about the world, but the word addiction still has certain taboo feelings associated with it. For some, when we use the word addiction, pictures come up in our minds of weekend drug binges or crack houses or petty theft to support a habit or addicts who are falling down drunk and vomiting on themselves or a compulsive need to hook up or visit prostitutes or frequent swinging orgies or some such thing. But the more that we understand about the way our brains work, the more we realize that addiction is built into the way we are wired. Addiction is rooted in the dopamine motivation cycle. Now, what the dopamine motivation cycle is this. Our brains thrive when they're at a state of equilibrium that's rooted in feeling good. Our brains do better, our lives do better, we do better when the feel good and feel bad are kind of brought into a place of stasis. And so the brain has a mechanism for doing that, and it is to pump out dopamine. The brain feels bad, and so it will pump out some dopamine to help it feel better. And there are certain things that we do that will help the brain feel better, help the brain surge out those chemicals. And we've come to do this through the generations because people who feel good are motivated. And motivated people do what needs to be done. And people who do what needs to be done tend to survive. And people who survive then pass their genes on to offspring. And then those genes become concentrated in the offspring so that each one of the generations carries more and more of this dopamine motivation cycle wired right into us more strongly in each successive generation. So this many generations later, you and I, we've got this. We've got this thing, and it's functioning in our brain. So if something will elevate dopamine, which eating sweet foods will do, or high-fat or high-starch content foods will do, our brains then are wired to gravitate toward it. That's why it's so hard to resist, you know, a donut when you drive by one. It's because over long periods of time, we realized if I eat that, it's going to bump up these chemicals. I'm going to feel better. Life will be good. A whole bunch of things will elevate dopamine. Working hard will do that. Succeeding at a goal. Getting the approval and the respect of the boss will do that. Or the grudging approval that we will give to ourselves because we've worked hard through the night. That'll bump up the feel good and then be motivated chemicals in our brains. So we'll have a couple of beers after work to relax. Or a couple of puffs on a joint will do the same. Or pills that will relax us or relieve our pain. Also, betting $50 on the NBA Finals will bump up the dopamine as well. Or winning an argument, or flirting with the guy at work, or having an impromptu roll in the hay in the afternoon, that'll do it. Looking at pornography will do it. So will buying a new pair of shoes, or buying a new electronic gadget, or hoarding money, or hoarding possessions. Any one of these things, not all of which are bad, any one of these things will kick in this chemical motivation cycle that goes on inside of our brains. Consequently, any one of those things is subject to that thing we call addiction, which is basically the overuse of any one of these things to pump up the surge of feel-good chemicals in our brains. It's not very difficult to go through an experience of one of these chemical surges and then want to go back to the thing that caused that surge and do it again. I want to do it again because I liked what it did for me last time. So each time we repeat the activity, we start doing things that get wired into the neural networks in our brains, what we call habits. So it's not long after we've done the thing that brings about the chemical burst and done it again and done it again and done it again that now we're dealing not only with the surging but also with the habit development process in our heads. And it's not long before the very motivation cycle that was working for us to get our brains to equilibrium have now started to work against us and are taking us into things that are not healthy for us and not good for us. But by the time that we realize that we're smoking too much dope or eating too many dark chocolates or working too many hours or buying too many pairs of shoes, by the time we realize we've gone across the line, the habit wiring is set because that's the thing that we do when our brains repeat activities again and again. So our brain infrastructure now is working against us. It's working against us by taking us back to familiar territory again and again, even though it is not helpful. So that's what brain chemical dependency looks like. We count on an activity to help us secrete those feel-good chemicals, and pretty soon we do the thing without much consideration because now it has just become habit, and we probably do it too much, and we probably do it too frequently. So again, this is a human thing, not necessarily a taboo thing. It's a how our brains work kind of thing more than it is those bad people or those weak people kind of thing that is often associated with the word addiction. Now, of course, some of our dopamine activities set the hook much more deeply. Opiates and alcohol will set the hook much more deeply than shoe buying will. But it's the same dynamic, it's the same mechanism at work in our brains. So it behooves us to become aware of the wisdom that has been gained by those who've been working with addiction for a long time. Because it's going to help us better know ourselves, and it's going to help us better know our go-to places. It's going to help us better know our default habits and how we get into them. So, the friend that I was talking with, he described for me a cycle that is, I guess, common in 12-step understanding. A lot of people have talked about this. And it applied, he thought, and I think, to this second step in the prayer practice. It is a cycle that once we understand it, we are now forewarned. And as you've heard me say many times, forewarned is forearmed. So here's the cycle. Triggers lead to cravings. Cravings lead to rituals. Rituals lead to doing the thing. Doing the thing leads to self-recrimination, and self-recrimination is itself a trigger, which then sets us up for a cycle. Here's how it goes. Something happens. A sad feeling comes up. You watch the news, and 9 people are killed in a church. Or your children hit a crisis moment. Or you have stress about the bank account when the statement comes. Or you're the recipient of a sharp word or a disapproving look. Or maybe you're the recipient of an approving look, but you've got a story that you tell yourself that you don't deserve approval. Maybe something goes off inside that says, that person just complimented me, and I don't deserve that compliment, and now I'm a fraud, and everyone's going to know it, and it's only going to be worse because now they've built me up in their minds, and when they find out the truth, or that person didn't compliment me, which means they must hate me, which means that all the doors that I need to walk through in my life aren't going to be opened for me, and or I missed a deadline. And then my story kicks in that tells me I cannot manage my life. I cannot schedule for my success. I can't do the things that I need to do. Or I have a bad hair day. Or I get on the scale and it's 4 pounds up. And my worth and appearance and love and value story kicks in. And I begin to carry around the weight. Whatever the trigger, and there are surely a million of them, something triggers us. Now, if we're paying attention to our afflictive emotions, remember this process, when the trigger comes, we're having a negative thought. The trigger functions up here in this realm of bad thought, bad word, bad deed. And if we do what the prayer of confession invites us to do, we immediately, upon sensing an afflictive emotion, begin the process of self-examination. What is the story I tell myself? What are the physical feelings? What are these things? So this triggers that if we're doing the process that we've been talking about. We're paying attention to our bodies and letting ourselves understand what those sensations mean and what they do to help us understand our feelings, and our feelings help us name them and then name the stories and help us ask better questions about what stories were. If we're doing all of that process, then afflictive emotions or triggers are our friends. But we usually don't. We usually don't pull out the prayer of confession early enough. We usually are well into the cycle before we catch ourselves. So the trigger comes, and the story that we tell ourselves kicks in. And that begins to create some negative or afflictive or bad feelings. And the brain needs equilibrium, so it tells us we need to fix things up. We need to take care of things, and so we start to crave the things that we know will fix things up. We start to crave the things that we know will bring about some feel-good to balance out the feel-bad. Now, wouldn't it have been great if you and I, early on in our habit formation, had created a go-to place like this? Ah, I'm feeling bad. I better get an extra good night's sleep tonight. Wouldn't it have been great if we decided, you know what, I'm feeling bad. I should probably have a conversation with a spiritual friend, or I should sit and do examine, or I should put in my journal, or I should begin to ask my questions. But most of the time, our habits are much quicker and much dirtier than that. Our cravings are much more primal than that. We don't have these great habits built in. You know what I need? I need a greasy sandwich. That's what I need. Or I need a trip to the ABC store. Or I need to go buy a new iPad. Or I need to work through the night so I can meet that deadline. Then I'll be getting something done. And so, my 12-step friend told me, after the cravings set in, we start a series of rituals, things that we do to package around doing the thing. Now, maybe it's the music that we play while we're in the car that's helping us get our mind where we're going, or the clothes that we associate with doing the thing, or the place in the house that we go, where we sit at the computer, or we wander downstairs near the fridge or near the cabinet, or maybe it's the friends that we call when we're preparing to do the things. We do the things that then become the support rituals for us when we do the thing. And he told me that the hard-won wisdom of the 12-step movement is by the time the rituals start, there's no stopping it. That's the last chance. By the time the rituals have started, that's when the signal that we're going to do the thing. That's what's going to happen. Which then takes us to the next stop in the cycle. We do the thing, and then after we've done it, now we begin to beat ourselves up for having done it. Again, damn it. Which is itself demoralizing and demotivating. And so our brains are demoralized and demotivated, which is kind of an afflictive emotion, which then begins to become the trigger itself that tells our brain, hey, I need some more feel-good chemicals to balance out the bad feeling that I have because I did the thing that I was doing in order to take care of the feel-bad in my brain. So we're triggered again, and the cycle is off to the races. And so it happens, and then we're 3 days or 3 weeks or 3 months or 3 years into this cycle of doing repetitively the unhelpful thing, which gives our brain equilibrium, which we wanted, but it costs us dearly in the process. And we are well into some significant period of time, trigger cascading over trigger over trigger, each wave deepening the habitual use of the thing and doing it with ever increasing intensity. And we can't seem to get off the train. And many among us, if not all of us, are very familiar with this pattern. We know how the cycle goes. It doesn't stop once the rituals begin. And to this state of affairs that will trap us in long periods of time, stuck in the unhelpful thing, to this state of affairs, our tradition offers a gift. And it is a prayer practice. It is the prayer of confession. It is the prayer of self-awareness and self-disclosure. And the brilliance of this practice is that it goes to the best place that we have to break the cycle. Because the cycle is very difficult to break after the trigger. So the prayer practice goes to addressing the trigger. We saw earlier that, or we'd heard that once the rituals start, the cycle can't be stopped. It's much harder to stop after the cravings start. So the best place to go after the cycle is to go right when the trigger begins to trigger, which we do when we dig into the story that we tell ourselves, which we do when we feel our feelings and we don't run from them. And we use them and name those feelings to help us fill in the story that we are telling ourselves. So after I had spoken with my friend, I looked at my own life, and sure enough, that trigger and craving and ritual and behavior and recrimination cycle, wow, I do that. I see how I do that. That just gave me a lens through which to look at the way life unfolds when I get into an unhealthy season of my life. What I really needed was to get more sleep. What I really needed was to talk this out with someone. What I really needed was to sit down with a piece of paper. What I really needed was to practice. But instead, I ramped up the energy and I ramped up the cycle. And when it came to the thing, I just determined that what I'll do next time is I'll just white knuckle this thing and I'll make sure that I won't do this thing ever again because it's not that healthy for me. And I'm pretty sure I'm not alone in this very familiar territory. The trigger, the craving, the rituals, the thing, the recrimination, which is the trigger. So, as we say, forewarned is forearmed, the place to break the cycle is to go after that. It's to go after the trigger. To go after it when the trigger is doing the triggering. So, as soon as we feel the bad feeling, as soon as we make the cutting remark, as soon as we do the bad action, as soon as we are the response to the coworker, as soon as that happens, the afflictive emotion is when we can actually begin to change the cycle. When the craving starts, again, harder. When the rituals start, too late. Turn around after that, we've done the thing. So now, have I mentioned, afflictive emotions are your friends. This is the time to start. This, when you've got the afflictive emotion, that's the time to begin the process. So, each week, you've seen me put these three steps on the wall. And step three has been, we've read it every time, we engage forthright self-disclosure. Now, you can see when you just see step three is coming, this prayer practice is a communal practice. This is something you do with other people. Because if you're going to engage in forthright self-disclosure, you're going to disclose to someone. So you can kind of see, this is a communal prayer practice as soon as you see the three steps up on the wall. But you've also seen that at step one and at step two, all along the way, I've been talking about how important it is to do our thinking one with another, to do our story examining one with another, to do our attentiveness to our negative emotions one with another, to unearth what those feelings mean and use them to backfill our stories one with another, and to do it with spiritual friends with whom we have trustworthiness and with whom we are trusted. And the same thing is true when we look at going after the triggers. It's going to be much better to do this if we do it with others. Here's another bit of wisdom that people in 12 Steps have told me about. When you feel the trigger, get on the phone. Call somebody. I was speaking with someone else who's part of a 12-step group, and he was wondering whether he should be in this group or in another because there's a whole bunch of different variants of different kinds of 12-step groups. And I asked him why he thought yes, and I asked him why he thought no. And along the way, he said this, you know, when I became part of this group, I received a list of X number of names, and I can't remember how many, but it was a big number. And he said, I didn't believe it at first, but they said, call this, somebody will pick up, you can talk. And he said, so I did it. And he said, it only takes about two or three names on the list before someone picks up. And those people are always ready to talk. And so I asked what they talk about. And he told me a lot of things that were going on in the conversations. But what I distilled it down to is they talk about the triggers. They talk about the stories that we tell ourselves. He didn't use those words, but that's what I heard, what they talk about when they get on the phone. We need spiritual friends to help us see that we've kicked into a trigger moment. We need spiritual friends in our lives to help us see that there's a story in play. We need spiritual friends in our lives. We need to be talking about our souls in a context that will help us know that these core feelings are leading to these feelings and this stuff is going on. The path of least resistance is just to follow that brain hardwired path and go where our brain always takes us. The path of least resistance is the cycle, but the cycle does not serve us well. So, having a network of spiritual friends in our lives helps us begin to go to the place where the cycle can be changed and begin to do the work that will change the cycle there. So as I've said throughout this lesson, I hope that you are creating your network of spiritual friendships. I hope that you are creating a place where you can talk about your soul safely. I'm hoping you are creating dynamics and mechanisms and rhythms into your life so that talking about your soul is a normative part of your week, because this is an essential part of the most transformative spiritual prayer practice I know. This prayer of confession is the most transformative prayer practice I know. And to have this work effectively, we need a network of spiritual friends in our lives. Now, one of the crusty barnacles that has attached itself to the prayer of confession through the centuries comes from both Rome and then, by the time we got into the 1500s, the Renaissance and the rise of Western individualism. when we became the recipients of the legacy of Western individualism, we became recipients of a set of instincts that have not served the prayer of confession well. And that is that we have tended through the last few hundred years, if we practice confession at all, we practice it as a very private affair. Confession is something that I, the individual, do. The community isn't all that involved. Most of the time, I make my confession privately to God. If you're part of the rhythm of church life, often that private confession happens on the Sunday when communion happens, and it happens in the few moments before you take communion. That's when you would make your private confession to God, a private prayer that lasts a few moments. But I hope you see that this prayer happens in community. It happens with real flesh and blood human beings who share the journey with us. I like the idea of making confession private because it's hard enough to talk about my darkness with God, but I certainly don't want to talk about it with you because you might think badly of me. You know what that might be? That might be a trigger. That's why it's important that we create community in which we can have these kinds of discussions and walk away at the end of that discussion knowing that we are loved, knowing that we are respected, and knowing that we are cared for. Shadows are a part of our souls. We've got them. All of us, every one of us have them. Trying to hide from them or trying to cover over them is a fool's errand. And so we create the community in which we can do the practice. The practice is transformative. All right, we'll pick up here next week, and we'll finish up this lesson. I hope we can finish it up next week, and we'll begin by looking at step 3. To be self-aware, God, to be free of a brain cycle, an addictive cycle, to be aware of the stories that we tell ourselves, to be sensitized to the feelings and to be able to understand how they fill in our story, this prayer of self-awareness and self-disclosure, this is our desire. And so may it be that we find our way into this rhythm, into this practice, into this form of prayer. May it be so in us, and may it be so among us in our community, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.